The American Philosophical Society supports WHYY. From giant sloths to Lewis and Clark, Thomas Jefferson promoted scientific discovery and westward expansion in the early United States. The exhibition, Jefferson, Science, and Exploration, reveals this legacy. Featuring historical fossils, maps, scientific instruments, and exquisite watercolors at the APS Museum now through December 27th. To learn more about the American Philosophical Society Museum, apsmuseum.org.
The daughter of a Temple physics professor accused of espionage says her father is the victim of profiling. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. That story's coming up. First, the third-degree murder trial of the general contractor charged in connection to 2013's deadly building collapse in Center City, Philadelphia, got underway today. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports.
On June 5, 2013, a 30-foot freestanding wall pancaked onto the neighboring Salvation Army thrift store at 22nd and Market Streets. The collapse killed six people and injured 13 more. Prosecutors argue that general contractor Griffin Campbell is a big reason why. They allege Campbell knowingly cut corners during a demolition that proved fatal. During her opening statement, Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Selber said Campbell flouted demolition standards in order to quickly sell the building's guts for a profit. Selber also says Campbell ignored multiple warnings that the wall was a severe safety hazard, including one handed down the night before the collapse. In a sometimes fiery stint before the jury, Campbell's attorney Bill Hobson argued that his client is a scapegoat, paying for the mistakes made by powerful decision makers above him. Hobson also alleges that others had chances to stop the collapse from happening. The trial is expected to last more than 3 weeks. Campbell is slated to testify. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Weeks after the chair of Temple University's physics department was exonerated of claims that he was an international spy, family members say not much has changed. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, federal prosecutors have dropped espionage charges against Shouxing Shi, but his daughter says they still have a long way to go to clear his reputation.
Joyce Shi will never forget the May morning when she heard a loud knock on the door of the family's Montgomery County house. A dozen armed federal agents were on the other side.
You know, we saw him get dragged away by the FBI agents, and then he was taken away, so we didn't know where he was, where he was going, or anything. After that, we kind of had a loss of words. We didn't know what was going on.
Prosecutors intercepted an email her dad, Shouxing Shi, sent to a Chinese firm. The feds interpreted that correspondence as evidence that he was leaking sensitive information overseas. Then the headlines came pouring forth.
People heard about it. People heard that my dad was an international spy, that he was selling secrets to China. And so we just didn't even know who we could talk to at that point.
Shouxing Shi, who came to the U.S. in the 80s, is an electronics expert who had sensitive blueprints for new technology that came about through a federal grant. Prosecutors thought he was sharing that information with a Chinese company, but Shi's attorney was able to prove that actually he had shared something totally unrelated as a matter of academic collaboration. He still has not been able to resume his work at Temple. Joyce Shi says she fields daily questions about her dad being a spy, as does her 13-year-old sister in school.
You know, it's a huge burden to overcome this reputational issue. It's going to take a lot of work to clear his name. And even though there's plenty of evidence, I think, to show that my dad didn't do what the government said that he did, that will always be on the internet, that will always be searchable, and people may always have their doubts.
The U.S. Attorney's Office in Philadelphia wouldn't comment on the dismissal of charges. A spokeswoman says it occurred in light of new information, but she wouldn't get more specific than that. Shi's attorney says the Department of Justice under President Obama has been eager to catch cybercriminals, especially ones leaking secrets to China. He says this case indicates that they may have been a little too eager. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
A billionaire and his bus cruised through Philadelphia yesterday, pausing briefly to hand out some sizable checks. AOL co-founder Steve Case made the stop as part of a five-day swing through the Northeast. He's highlighting the work of entrepreneurs in places not generally thought of as hotbeds of innovation. WHYY's Todd Bookman reports.
Steve Case got the kind of introduction you could only get in this city this week.
First and foremost, welcome to the Pope of Entrepreneurship. Oh, I'm sorry, different event.
Mayor Nutter welcomed the Pope of Entrepreneurship during a kickoff breakfast. This is the fourth time the America Online co-founder has packed his toothbrush and checkbook for a little road trip. Earlier tours took him through Detroit and Des Moines. So by now, Case is comfortable holding court on his coach bus.
Our 16th city, we're trying to showcase great entrepreneurs building great companies and some of these places that don't get the attention that Silicon Valley gets or New York gets. And so far, we've seen already seen great companies in Philly. We think the startup scene in Philly has great promise.
Case calls these bus tours the rise of the rest. And each city he visits has different reasons for not yet being the next Silicon Valley. In the Delaware Valley, there are still big obstacles to overcome, from the quality of public schools to tax policy to the lack of big investors.
Well, I think these things take time, and they take the community rallying around the entrepreneurs, supporting the entrepreneurs. It takes some companies having the kind of breakout success that people around the country notice that then attracts more talent, attracts more capital. It's a classic kind of momentum begets momentum, you know, kind of thing.
Case stopped his bus outside some of the local companies that have already gained some traction. That includes RJ Metrics, a software company in Center City. Their office has all the trappings of a startup, including the ping pong table, plus a gong they ring to celebrate big sales. Co-founder Jake Stein says entrepreneurs shouldn't dwell on the region's startup shortcomings. The focus should be on the business model, because if that's solid, the money will come no matter where you are.
So we've raised $22 million right here in Philadelphia. Most of it is from venture investors that are on the West Coast, some of it in New York, a couple people right here in Philly as well. I think the honest truth is that the best companies in the world can raise money no matter where they are. So the focus ought to be on building an amazing company, and then you can find investors who want to work with you.
Still, it isn't easy making it in smaller tech towns. 75% of all venture capital in America went to businesses in just three states last year, California, New York, and Massachusetts. Steve Case wants to level that playing field, and not just geographically, but also by changing the face of innovation. He put some money behind that concept during the last stop of his visit, an event at the National Constitution Center. Eight businesses had 5 minutes to pitch their ideas, the winner taking home a $100,000 investment.
All right, the winner, Scholly.
Scholly is an 18-month-old app that streamlines the search for college scholarships. Its founder, Christopher Gray, accepted the check and thanked not just Case for the money, but also the community for its support.
Philly does that better than any city, really providing opportunity to everyone, whether you're a woman, whether you're black, you're LGBT, or whoever. And it's powerful, and I'm excited to be here. And I'm hoping that Scholly can help more students in Philadelphia and across the nation. So thank you. Thank you.
Gray is right out of the Rise of the Rest playbook. The simple belief that good ideas can come from anyone and valuable companies can start anywhere. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Turning to this evening's headlines, the Philadelphia alternative weekly paper, City Paper, will stop printing after being purchased by a company whose investors include the publishers of a rival publication. Broad Street Media said today it expects to incorporate City Paper's best features into the competitor, Philly Weekly. It also will combine their websites. City Paper will cease print publication October 8th. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has pardoned three people who faced gun possession charges in New Jersey. Christie today pardoned Todd Doering, Brian Fletcher, and Elizabeth Griffin, whose charges stem from separate incidents. The pardons come after Christie cleared the records earlier this year of Stephen Josie Davis and Shanine Allen, both charged with unlawful possession. The Republican presidential hopeful has pointed to the gun-related pardons as evidence of his support for the Second Amendment, this as he's tried to make his case to skeptical conservative voters. 74 degrees, gray skies at 6:15. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Still ahead, a lesson on legibility from longtime concert poster artist Bonnie McLean.
They thought that was what you're supposed to do. If they're psychedelic, they shouldn't be legible. If you can read it, it's not working, in other words. But that was never my thing.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Art and Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Equivocation, starting October 22nd, a comedy about Shakespeare, where he receives a royal commission to write a historical play on a treasonous act and must find a way to tell the truth without losing his head. For tickets, 215-922-1122 or at artintheater.org. Art and Theater Company supports WHYY.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. The Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson is a National Cancer Institute designated center whose physicians and scientists seek to transform scientific discoveries into more precise diagnosis and individualized treatments to improve outcomes and quality of life for patients with cancer. To schedule an appointment or for more information, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jefferson.edu. Thomas Jefferson University Hospital.
Ego Poe Classic Theater supports WHYY and presents the American Giants Festival, celebrating America's great female playwrights, featuring three powerful classics, Lillian Hellman's 1934 drama, The Children's Hour, Claire Booth Luce's sizzling comedy, The Women, and Sophie Treadwell's expressionist masterpiece, Mach and All. All presented with dynamic new stagings. The festival kicks off October 7th. For tickets, egopoe.org or 267-273-1414.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Pennsylvania State Police have struggled to boost their racial diversity for decades, and the pressure to do so could intensify under Governor Tom Wolf's administration. As WHYY's Mary Wilson reports, former state troopers say the agency does not need more time or resources, just the drive to change.
There are a lot of things you notice at a Pennsylvania State Police graduation. The lone bagpipe player leading cadets to their seats. Proud families craning to get a glimpse of their soon-to-be trooper. And white people, mostly white people.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me.
This class about to take the oath of office has 84 cadets. Six of them are racial minorities. The state police have struggled with racial diversity for years. In 1973, they were taken to court by a civil rights lawyer alleging discriminatory hiring practices for blacks. Racial minorities made up about 2% of the state police ranks at that time. The case was settled with a consent decree that imposed strict hiring and promotion rules for racial minorities. There was a surge in black recruits. But in 1999, the consent decree was lifted, and the hiring of blacks took a dive. The state police had explanations. The agency was competing with big businesses and city police departments for minority candidates, and they had to overcome distrust among the very communities they wanted to recruit.
I don't see that the department has lost its vigor to be diverse.
Lieutenant Paul Gaspich is a former recruitment director who's still with the state police.
We have a lot of retirements in the last few years that makes it look like our numbers have drastically dwindled, but our effort has not dwindled, if that makes sense.
Racial and ethnic minorities represent more than 21% of Pennsylvania's population. They make up just 6% of the overall state police force. Blacks alone make up 3%. But now there are people who have been on the inside, trying to change the way the state police pursue minority candidates. And now those people are ready to talk.
The big hat man. The state police was always known as the big hat man across the country.
Rick Brown keeps his state police hat on display in his home office. It's one of many mementos of his career with the agency. He retired about 5 years ago. The walls here are covered with framed awards and pictures. He points to a photo of his state police academy class.
Half minority, half non-minority. These classes that were half minority, where we were considered green troopers, meaning Judge Clifford Scott Green.
Green was the federal judge who had ordered a consent decree in response to the lawsuit alleging rampant discrimination at the state police. Midway through Brown's career, the decree was lifted, meaning the state police would no longer face strict hiring and promotion rules. The number of racial minorities in the state police began dropping after that. Lawmakers would ask about it at public hearings.
But the state police response consistently at budget hearings, we can't get enough qualified applicants. I've always thought that was garbage.
In 2008, as Brown neared retirement, he was asked to oversee the agency's recruiting effort. He figured he had 2 years to prove he could find more minority candidates for the state police with smarter recruiting. He took it on with the zeal of a missionary and the vocabulary of a marketing executive.
It's about getting our product out to those targeted groups. We can find white male candidates all over the planet. We can't find enough minorities, people of color, and women.
Brown prides himself on his work ethic, and he expected a lot from his team of state police recruiters.
Are they being accessible in the evenings? Are they working 8 to 4 banker's hours? And it wasn't popular when I said, you might have to work a weekend because your candidate might work all week. There was a little bit of like grumbling at first. I'm like, we're police officers. We work 24/7. If you want to work for the bank, go work for the bank.
Under Brown's leadership, the state police made applicant tests more convenient to schedule and take for people living in the state's major cities. Recruiters based in Philadelphia started a mentoring program. When there were complaints that people conducting lie detector tests were biased, Brown's team had the sessions videotaped to make test administrators accountable for what happened in the room. Recruiters hosted open house events at state police facilities, and Brown pushed his team to look for ever more ways to find potential candidates. About a year later, 2009, Brown was starting to see his team's hard work pay off. Racial minorities made up a quarter of his roster of cadet candidates. These were people who had passed a written test and were invited to an interview. Brown told the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus that it was the most diverse list of cadet candidates since 1999, when federal oversight of state police employment practices ended.
It was all of a sudden now we're finding the applicants. We debunked the myth. And as a minority, you get tired of hearing that. We can't find qualified minorities or women. Oh, wait a minute.
But we won't know if Brown's efforts would have made a difference to the state police's overall diversity. The recession cratered funding for state police training, delaying the next class for recruits by about a year. Many of the candidates recruited by Brown's team moved on to other opportunities. The agency says many of the initiatives spearheaded by Brown and his team remain in place. Lie detector tests are still recorded on video. There's still an emphasis on community outreach and open house events. The efforts to make applicant tests more accessible have stuck. Corporal Daniel Gonzalez is a longtime state police recruiter. He says the agency has not wavered in its commitment to diversity since he's been there.
Obviously, we have a lot more work to do. We definitely want to increase our numbers, and we're just going to continue to work hard on that.
But a mentoring program that started in Philadelphia petered out after Brown retired and other members of the recruitment team moved on. The same state budget cuts that quashed new cadet classes led the state police to send its recruiters back to patrol duties for 8 months. The move happened 3 days after Brown retired. He felt it showed a lack of commitment. There is also the delicate subject of who is in charge. Brown is a black man. His head of recruitment was black. The unit is now run by 2 white women.
It's not bad, it just is.
John Bay worked under Brown as recruitment director. He retired from the state police and is now chief of police for Middletown in Dauphin County. He wonders if it's possible to care enough about diversity if it isn't personal.
They're not nefarious, mean-spirited people. They're very big-hearted. They'll give their life in a heartbeat for you. But from a diversity and recruitment perspective, they just don't have the background.
For the small team that tried to reinvigorate state police recruitment several years ago, it feels like the clock has been rolled back. It's been more than 40 years since a federal judge took the agency to task for not hiring enough racial minorities. The state police are still trying to find their sense of urgency. Mary Wilson in Harrisburg.
A new music venue will open in Philadelphia this week, the Fillmore, named after the famous clubs in San Francisco and New York that helped give birth to modern rock and roll, will open in the Fishtown neighborhood. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the new club's inaugural poster was created by one of the original Fillmore's psychedelic poster artists.
Bonnie McLean has been quietly painting in a converted barn in Bucks County for 43 years. But before that, she lived the fast-paced life of San Francisco in the 60s. She moved there in 1963 when she says flower power still meant something.
I mean, it was a nice idea at first, but unfortunately then when the summer of love rolled in, so did all those little kids, all those teenagers who got there with nothing. They had no money. They couldn't work. They all got into drugs. It was sad.
During that time, McLean met and married Bill Graham, the impresario who championed psychedelic rock at the Fillmore.
We were there around the clock, practically. We were there a lot. So, of course, I saw a lot of all the shows. Loved that part of it. One of my favorite groups was Cream, who came from England. More sophistication in these groups that came in from elsewhere, although I've got to watch what I say and what everybody's feelings, but that's the way I saw it anyway.
McLean always had an interest in art, but no training. In college, she studied French. Nevertheless, her husband asked her if she would make posters for upcoming Fillmore shows. Her posters always centered on a face, sometimes surrounded by Gothic architectural designs, and the important things like the name of the bands, the date, the time, the place, swirled around in bubbly letters. Unlike a lot of her peers, McLean never made that text unreadable.
Some of them did that deliberately because they thought that was what you're supposed to do. If they're psychedelic, they shouldn't be legible. If you can read it, it's not working, in other words. But that was never my thing, and Bill didn't want it to be illegible because, well, that's not advertising. If nobody can read it, what's the point?
McLean divorced Graham in 1975, relocated to Bucks County, where she now paints figurative nudes and still lives. And she says what happened in San Francisco stayed in San Francisco.
I mean, I don't work in any way that was influenced by those posters, and I don't have any success because of that era. There are so many people who collect posters, but they are not at all interested in anything else I do.
McLean designed the poster for the first concert at the new Fillmore in Philadelphia, headlined by Hall & Oates. She says it will be in the old Fillmore style, but don't call it psychedelic. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, Pennsylvania Congressman Bob Brady has received a lot of flack for stealing Pope Francis's used water glass after the Pope's congressional address. And last night, Stephen Colbert weighed in. The newly minted host of The Late Show criticized Brady's plans of drinking the leftover water and sprinkling it on his grandchildren as a blessing.
Congressman Brady, here's the thing. It won't give you superpowers, all right? It's not like getting bitten by a radioactive Pope.
The congressman has even employed the Philadelphia Police Department to dust the glass for prints so that it can be officially authenticated as Pope used. Colbert noted that Brady's a repeat offender in the drinking glass-stealing world, having pulled the same stunt in 2009 after Barack Obama's inauguration. But the late-night host failed to mention that Brady attempted to atone for his theft by offering to pay to replace the glass. Turns out that amounts to just $3.94. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Supporting WHYY, Akamai, working to ensure consistent web and mobile experiences to fend off cyber attacks and deliver online video at scale. More at akamai.com.
Support for WHYY comes from Comcast NBC Universal. Since 2011, more than 2 million low-income people have benefited from low-cost, high-speed internet through the Internet Essentials program. Learn more at comcastcorporation.com/IE.
Proudly supporting WHYY is New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, educating businesses, local governments, schools, and residents how to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing facilities with assistance from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.